Welcome to our Writers' Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University, a program sponsored by the Journalism Program at Point Loma Nazarene University and the Society of Professional Journalists, the San Diego Pro Chapter. I'm Dean Nelson on the Journalism faculty at Point Loma, and with us tonight is Chitra Divakaruni, a poet, a novelist, columnist. Her most recent book is Sister of My Heart. Before that, she wrote Mistress of Spices. And before that, her collection of short stories, Arranged Marriage. They're all very different in form. Collection of short stories, Mistress of Spices, which struck me almost as a long poem, a long narrative poem in novel form. We can talk about that in a minute, I hope. And this most recent book, The Sister of My Heart, a novel. They are all different in form, but some things that emerge out of these, Chitra, strike me as very, very similar. And I wanted to see if this is an accurate characterization in your opinion. The characters usually begin in all of these books with a great deal of hope. Then they find they have some sort of experience with disappointment in what they were headed for, what they thought they were headed for. And then they find something completely different by the end of the works, either by the end of the story or by the end of the novels. It might be that they have hope in their families and in their marriage, in love and in America, but then something happens. And on the other side of that something happens, they experience something brand new, and that's how we're left at the end of the stories or novels. Now, would that be accurate in your view, that they start out this way, and it dies or diminishes considerably, but a new experience takes place?
Yes, I think you're right. I didn't see it before this.
That's why you're here. Well, okay, so that's not a conscious thing on your part.
No, I don't think it's conscious, but I think one of the things that I like to show in my stories or like to explore in my stories is how life takes a very different course often from what we expect, and how life is full of surprises, and how the consolations and triumphs in life come from very unexpected directions.
I'm thinking specifically about a character in Sister of My Heart who goes to her wedding with tremendous expectation, tremendous hope, and something happens at the wedding, and you can just tell right there that this marriage is not going to be what she thought it was going to be on her wedding day.
Right.
And yet, by the end of the novel, we still have something to cling to.
Right, right. Anju, you're talking
yes.
about Anju and Sister of My Heart, and that is exactly what happens to her. And I think that just goes to show again, as human beings, we hold on to particular ideas, maybe even time-tested or stereotypical notions of happiness. And we discover that happiness is something quite different.
What would some of those stereotypical notions be?
Well, in the case of Sister of My Heart, one of them, of course, is the idea of romance and marriage, which in the context of traditional...
You can't have those two?
In the context of traditional Indian society, that's supposed to occur together. And both Sudha and Anju, the two main characters mm-hmm. in Sister of My Heart, find it's not that simple.
Right. There are some other kinds of themes like that. People with certain expectations coming to America, for instance. And those expectations change dramatically, similar to the expectations of what a marriage would be. Again, was that is that a purposeful idea on yours, or is it just one of these reflections of this is part of the human experience?
No, I think in that case, this was certainly a theme that I wanted to consciously explore. And I've said this before in talking to you, that to me it seems like each age has its own myths and legends. Mm-hmm. And in the 20th century, America is one of the last myths and legends that still exist.
What does that mean?
I think what that means is that For many people all over the world who are planning to come to America, they view this as the golden land, the land where once you get here, everything will be all right.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, better than all right. Everything will be perfect. Everything you ever wanted, you have an opportunity to get it. And so many people continue to come to America with this dream and then find out that just like every other place, America has its problems.
Right.
It has its good points and then it has its negatives.
Okay. Now, this leads nicely into one of the issues I wanted to get at with you. You have said in a previous interview that dissolving boundaries is what living is all about. And I'm wondering, is that your hope for how you write, too, that your writing dissolves boundaries? And if so, what boundaries are we talking about?
Yes, I certainly hope for that through my writing. One of the most obvious boundaries that I hope to dissolve is that between the writer and the reader, creating a connection. The book becomes the connection between the writer and readers of different cultures, different backgrounds, so that the book gives people of South Asian origins an insight, hopefully, into themselves and their own culture, and of people of other cultures. My hope is that not only does it tell them something about the Indian context of life, but also show them some commonalities of human experience, make them relate to and empathize with people who on the surface seem very, very different from them, but ultimately have many of the same hopes and many of the same challenges.
So in dissolving boundaries, that could be cultural ones, it could be the separation naturally between a reader and a writer, but when you see characters who are dissolving boundaries, your idea then would be that those things that separate us as human beings don't have to separate us.
Don't have to. I think our differences are wonderful, but our similarities in some ways are even more wonderful. And a character, for example, like Thilo in Mistress of Spices, actively works at dissolving boundaries between herself and the people she comes to love, the people who come to her store, whom she tries to help, between herself and the new world. And she is definitely placed within certain boundaries. She has been enjoined never to leave the spice store. That's the boundary. And that's one of the boundaries she dissolves as she steps into America.
Right. She, early in the book, she's a bridge between these two groups, and then she steps across it
herself.
Herself. Is dissolving boundaries one of the reasons why you write? Is that a motive for you?
I think so. I think that is very important in my own life. I think one of my hopes is that perhaps through the books, boundaries will be dissolved between my community and the other many other wonderful communities that make up the American mosaic. And that hopefully through reading the books and perhaps relating to the characters, people will come to see people who are not like themselves, not just the characters in the book, but characters out there that perhaps they didn't think about or relate to. They'll come to see them a little differently.
Okay. Now, one of the groups that takes consistently a pretty good hit in your books is men.
You think so?
I think so. I was almost offended. Are we really that bad? I'm trying to ignore the audience for a moment and just concentrate on you. Are we as bad as we look?
Maybe I should ask the audience.
No. Let's pretend the audience isn't here. Are we as bad as we look?
Well, I hope what I've tried to show in my books, which are admittedly woman-centered, and strong women are at the heart of the books, and the stories are told from the points of view of the women. It's their story, and therefore they're presented with greater sympathy and greater empathy. But I hope what I've shown is that the men are complex characters. They're caught in many social institutions and emotional baggage that they have carried for a long time. And I certainly hope I haven't shown them as villains.
No. No.
Although maybe they're not the heroes.
they're not heroes. But one of the things I thought was intriguing about all of the works of yours that I've read is that while men are not portrayed necessarily as heroes, I never got the impression that you were only writing to women. That was never an impression, and I'm just baffled as to how you did that. How can you make men look the way you do, make them look, and yet not be so marginalized as a women's writer? How have you done that?
Well, that's because when certain men read my books, they say, well, I'm not as bad as those guys.
Oh, I see where this is going.
And then they feel better about themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And then they buy the book and they give it to all their men friends so that they can all feel.
You raised that as one possibility. Are there others?
I think what I hope for with my men readers, and I have great faith in this, that at least many thoughtful men readers, there are many thoughtful men readers out there who are interested in reading a story from a woman's point of view, mm-hmm. who are curious about how such a story would be told, how a woman would see a situation as different, and who are therefore, and who applaud strong women. Mm-hmm. That is my great hope.
Okay. I'm guessing they're reading this book too. All right. That's important. Now, let me ask you something else about something that you do in your writing that I've never seen anybody do with the strength and the skill that you do.
What? Tell
you,
me.
You involve a sense of smell in all of your work. I've never seen that that strongly as I have in yours. Is that intentional, or is that something from, you know, your culture that just says it's always been a part of what we do, and so as a natural expression of that, you know, the smell of sandalwood, the smell of different very specific flowers and spices is always prominent. Is that an intentional thing?
I think it's a couple of things. Partly it's intuitive, mm-hmm. and in general I like to write in a way that involves the reader's senses, because I like reading things that do that. Mm-hmm. And so I want to involve all their senses. The second thing is that the tropical world, the Indian world that I often write about, is a world of very vivid smells. The mm-hmm. tropical flowers, the spices, the sweat, the
yeah.
heat and
right.
dust and
right.
all of that. I think all of that becomes a big part of the Indian world. And therefore, when I'm describing the American world, mm-hmm. you know, I'm looking for correlations. And therefore, I'm looking for smells that would describe the American world as well.
What are the dominant smells in the American world?
Chinese takeout.
Good.
That plays a big part in Sister of My Heart.
It does. It does. When things are going bad, or badly, pardon me, yeah, Chinese takeout.
Becomes
a character in those stories. That's true. All right. What else besides Chinese takeout?
I'll have to think for a while.
All right.
Come back to it.
All right. We'll come back to it. All right. But something. Now there are some dark pieces to many of the things that you've written. There are, while your writing always has some kind of theme about independence and loyalty and families and tradition, there's also a lot of reference to domestic violence and to crime and to economic disparity, abortion and divorce. And I'm wondering if your time working with the women, the South Asian women that you did in the Bay Area, if that has had that kind of an impact on introducing those kinds of dark pieces to your writing, or would that have happened anyway? In other words, your real world experience, has that had that kind of an effect?
Yes, definitely. I think the numerous years that I've been spending now working not only on Maitri, the South Asian mm-hmm. women's hotline, but also in mainstream shelters, has really made me sensitive to those issues. particularly issues of women's abuse. Mm-hmm. And also the work that I've done in general with my community has made me aware of the problems that immigrants face. Mm-hmm. A number of racism, problems dealing with racism,
right,
and inequality, and just being made to feel perhaps unwelcome in America. And so these issues become very important in my writing.
Were you sensitive to those issues before you worked in these shelters and in these groups?
I think I was aware of them. I became aware of them actually pretty early in mm-hmm. my experience here. The second day that I was in America, something happened in my life which later became a story in Arranged
right.
Marriage called Silver Pavements, Golden Roofs, and where I was out on a street walking in my Indian clothes, and mm-hmm. a group of teenagers came up and shouted names and mm-hmm. Called me nigger and told me to go home and threw slush at me. It was a very frightening and very traumatic experience. So I was certainly aware of that, and it became something that made me suddenly realize that life in America was going to be very different from life in India, which had a number of challenges, but where my skin color had never been an issue.
Wow. Which goes to the theme of expectations and having to alter those
right.
expectations.
Right. But also the other side of that, which I've found in America, is that there have been wonderful things that I never expected. I mean, people who have been very kind, very mm-hmm. open, groups, especially other ethnic groups with whom I felt so much at home, and friendships mm-hmm. that I've been able to have, which I really wouldn't have had in India.
Okay. Now let's talk specifically about your craft of writing. You have also said in previous interviews that you have to be prepared to give things up for writing. What kinds of things do we need to be giving up? What did you have to give up?
The X-Files.
Boy, there's some high literature. Anything else?
Well, I think I've had to make some decisions about what are the priorities in my life, and then just try to live a life that is simple mm-hmm. and cut away things that I felt were not essential to my sense of well-being and to my sense of doing what is important in the world.
Okay, so if you're giving things up, so that isn't really giving up, that's just reordering.
But, you know, there were a lot of things perhaps that I enjoyed doing, but that weren't really giving me things that were important back in return.
Okay. Okay.
You know?
If, I'm thinking of another interview that you did that had to do with also trying to balance being a mother and writing and some of the difficulties there. As anybody in the audience who has tried to write and have small children in the house, you know that can be that can be a challenge. But one of the things that came out of that, almost as an aside, in one of your Salon columns, I think it was, that said you realized you couldn't write about your children, but you could write about being a mother. Now, why that and not that?
Well, even writing about being a mother is difficult for me, but I think it's a more introspective and internal thing.
Okay.
Whereas when I try to write about my children, my obvious emotion gets in the way, and I don't see them clearly and objectively. However, having children has really helped me write about fictional characters who are parents and children, because I understand that relationship, the dynamics, the tension of that relationship much better. Now, when I write about my own children, I turn into mush.
Yeah, I believe you said it sounded like Hallmark cards.
Bad
Hallmark cards. That's right. That was in there, wasn't it? So is that just because you're too close?
I'm too close to them.
Okay.
Yes.
So you can be too close to an experience.
Oh, yes. And in general, it takes me many years of internally processing an experience before I can start writing about it. My whole writing career started about more than 10 years after I moved over here. So I had to let that experience of immigration process itself for a number of years before I could start writing about
That's right, because you were in your 30s or something before you had something published here.
Right.
And so you didn't come over here from India with the idea of
being
I am a writer and I'm going to become trained as a writer.
No, no. In fact, even nowadays, sometimes I ask myself, I'm a writer? Me?
Huh.
You know, there's a sense of amazement,
yeah,
truly, in my life when I think of that. And I think I kind of slipped into being a writer just through doing it and persevering and trusting in it. And I did begin by writing very bad poetry, very sentimental poetry.
That's all right. There's room for that.
However, I have since destroyed that, so no one will ever know exactly how bad it was.
Actually, I have found some. No.
And he's going to read it.
No, just kidding. That's just what a man would do.
I'm going to write a story about it. And maybe this man will be named Dean Nelson
in
the story.
No, I don't think so. All right. Here's a quote from Sister of My Heart, from one of your characters, that says, "That's the thing about us human beings. When we really love someone, we can be happy even when our heart is breaking." I think you've just defined the human experience with a statement like that. Is that your philosophy that you wanted this character to say? Was that one of those, it was just true to the character kinds of things? The whole world spins on a statement like that. Where did that come from?
Well, I think partly, you know, the primary impulse was that it came out of the character and her situation and her understanding of the situation. But I think I do agree with that. And I'm glad to see that you do too.
Well, yeah, I think that sums it up. I think so. Have both experiences simultaneously.
Yes. I think that's one of the complexities of human emotion and human loving, that you can love in the best cases, in the most unselfish cases. You can be unhappy and happy at the same time because you can put someone else's life in front of yours, which is what Sudha and Anju keep doing for each other in Sister of My Heart, in spite of the fact that they often exasperate each other and, you know, that they're often not agreeing about things.
They put themselves in front of each other's, put themselves at risk for the other to such an extent that it causes them tremendous
grief.
anguish and,
yes,
and grief.
Yes.
Is that your worldview right there, that this is what human beings do?
I think I would say that's my view of, or my hope and my understanding, that human beings can do that. It's not that we do that often.
Mm-hmm.
We do that rarely, but when it does happen, it's wonderful. And it's definitely worth celebrating.
Okay. Now, we're coming to a bit of a close here. And there are a number of people in the audience who are writers and a number of people who see themselves as eventually being writers and a number of people who will be watching this program who vision themselves that way. Can you give them some advice? And you've got a whole range of published people to wishful people. What's your best advice for writers?
Well, I don't know if it's my best one. It's one that I tell my students often.
Okay.
One is to read widely. One, that's one. Two is to steal even more widely.
You sounded more like an academic all the time. Read widely and steal widely. Is there a third, or can we just rest on those two?
No, I think the most important thing is really to believe in yourself and keep writing. Writing takes a lot of work. This has been my experience. And you have to throw away a lot of things you write. And sometimes we're so attached to what we write, we can't bear the thought of having to throw it away.
True.
And so I tell my students, don't be afraid to throw things away. And if you really can't throw it away, get an empty shoebox and put them in there. And don't take them out for a long time.
And then throw that away. Right, right, exactly. Exactly. All right, so when you say, let's go back to your advice here, read widely. Only read good writers, acclaimed writers, read everything. What would you...
Well, I think we read for so many different purposes.
Right.
When we are reading in order to improve our writing, we should really be very careful who we pick and choose. And we should read people whose work we can learn from, whose work inspires us, whose work reminds us why we wanted to become a writer in the first place.
Whose work we can steal from.
Exactly.
Exactly.
He's catching up.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I do have some advice of a different kind for people who are suffering from writer's block.
Okay.
And what I say to them is, when you're really blocked and you can't write, and even reading the wonderful, inspiring people just makes you, you know, more blocked because they're so wonderful. Read some really bad books.
Oh, that's good advice.
And then when you see how bad those writers are and the fact that they were so bad and still they got published, you'll really be inspired.
You could say, I could do that.
Exactly.
Right, okay. Now, I've also heard on the issue of writer's block that there is no such thing as writer's block. That writer's block is only a lack of material. It's a lack of paying attention to the world, and it's a lack of eavesdropping in conversations around you. What do you think?
I think those people who said that weren't writers.
Really? Interesting. Okay. Have you ever had writer's block?
I constantly have writer's block. I have writer's block very regularly, let's put it this way. I think we all go through dry periods and then periods when we are very productive.
Mm-hmm.
And often what's happening during our periods of writer's block is that we're processing things. We're probably processing things and we're not ready. We don't know how to express them. So I think of those periods as, I mean, they're very painful and frustrating periods, but I think one needs to work through them.
Okay. I want you to tell us what you're working on now, what we can expect to see in your next work after Sister of My Heart.
I'm working on a collection of short stories now.
Oh, good.
And I'm working on, again, exploring another part of the immigrant experience. I think a number of these stories are going to focus on parent-child relationships.
Hmm.
First of all, the parents that we leave behind in our home countries when we immigrate to America, what happens to them, their loneliness, their isolation when they're back home, but also when they come to join their loved ones here and discover that perhaps they don't fit into this life, into this lifestyle, that they cannot really communicate anymore with their children or their grandchildren. The other side of that is, of course, us as parents bringing up children in America, the second generation, the children who are far more American than we will ever be. How do we connect to them? How do we pass on things to them? What do we pass on to them?
Given the way our country has evolved, that sounds like a very, very important and powerful theme. Thank you so much for being with us. This has been wonderful.
Thank you, Dean.